Tonight, thinking about every preacher's favorite topic about which to preach, and every congregation's favorite topic to listen to. But it is a biblical topic, and it's one that requires our consideration, our attention, from time to time, and sometimes requires gentle reminders on the part of those who are doing the best they can to preach and teach and guide the congregation, the importance of giving. And by giving, there are a lot of ways you could approach just that topic. Giving of our time, giving of ourselves, our energy, any number of things. But we are primarily concerned about money in the lesson tonight, and primarily concerned about the collection that we take up as a local church. This local church takes up a collection on the first day of every week. We do that because we have a pattern in the New Testament. It's not a significant pattern. Not a lot of verses in the New Testament speak to this. But there was a need, and we read about it. You can be turning to 1 Corinthians 16. Some of you were probably already turning there. But there were needy saints, and there was a need for money to be taken up for their assistance, for their aid. And the Apostle Paul gives the church at Corinth instructions about how to collect money for that need. Not only had he given these instructions to the church at Corinth, but he also says in verse 1 that he had directed the churches of Galatia to do the same thing. And so we presume, based on that these were instructions that Paul had given to all the churches that participated in this particular need. And the teaching was this, very simple. On the first day of the week, every one of you is to put aside and save as he may prosper so that no collection be made when I come. There's not any question that what he's talking about here is a common treasury. The collection is to be put into a common treasury. And that collection is to be taken up on the first day of the week. And so what we have in this pattern is we have a need that was a legitimate need. It was a need in which the local church had the right to be engaged. It's a need that involves money. And the question becomes then, how does the local church raise the money to do the work that God instructed the local church to do? And Paul's teaching, again, here as in other churches, take up this collection, this offering from the members on the first day of the week. And so we reason from that if a local church has a right to do any work, and that work is going to involve money of some kind or another, then what would the pattern be for raising the money to do that work? And this is the only pattern that I know of that we have anywhere in the New Testament. How did a local church raise money to do a work that God approved of, that God wanted them to do? They took up a voluntary collection of the members on the first day of the week. How would we then raise money in a way that we know would be acceptable and pleasing to God? There are a lot of ways that we could raise money. And there are probably some inventive and creative ways that we might raise money that would enable us to raise a lot more money than we do. But the question is, how can we do it in a way that we know is acceptable and pleasing to God? And so we appeal to this pattern. We know that we can ask the members to participate in this collective contribution, that contribution be taken up on the first day of the week, and then that money used to meet that need, whatever the need is. Several questions are raised. Sometimes the question is, well, why do we do this on the first day of every week? This seems to be just a specific need. And in point of fact, it is just a specific need. My answer to that question would be that I assume that the only time that a church would take up a collection is when there is some specific need. But my response would go further than that. My response is, and especially in this country, with all the ways that God has prospered us materially, and with all the opportunities we have to do work, it's difficult to conceive of or imagine a week going by when there's not a need that is a legitimate need. The needs are continual. The needs are ongoing. And the request for needs never stops. And so that explains why we generally take up a collection. As a matter of fact, I've never known us to not do this, to take up a collection on the first day of every week, because we have ongoing needs. And those needs, then, we have to be able to justify those needs from the Scriptures. Are we spending that money on things that we know would be acceptable and pleasing to God? There are several reasons for doing a lesson like this. One of them I've already suggested. We need to be reminded from time to time to examine ourselves when it comes to our giving. We've talked about, the members here know that we've been talking about for a long time now, but we've been talking in a very intense and serious way in the last 10 months about the possibility of doing something to give us more space in which to meet, whether that would be expanding the current auditorium or building an additional auditorium that would be attached to this building. And it was very disturbing to us as elders to discover that there are lots of people in Bowling Green who would be happy to build us a new building, but they all want money. And as a matter of fact, it's been right distressing to discover how much money some of these people want to do that kind of work. And so I know there have been questions on the part of the members where, you know, you said back in January that we were looking to do something to give us more space, and now here we are almost at the 1st of October and we haven't done anything yet. I assure you that it's not for lack of effort. It's not for lack of trying. It is an effort, a diligent effort on the part of the elders to try to find the most efficient way that we can do what we need to do to meet the needs of this local congregation and do it in such a way that we can justify the expense. That expense is going to come, that money is going to come from this voluntary free will offering that the members of the local church make. And so that's a reason to consider from time to time, or to remind ourselves from time to time, about the importance of giving. I will say this, I'm not preaching this lesson because I perceive that we have a problem in the church here. As a matter of fact, this group seems to me to be extremely generous in terms of the contribution that they give. But that's not to suggest at all that all of us are giving what we should be giving on the first day of the week. Or that even those of us who are giving, those of the members here who are giving, a large amount of money perhaps, and giving what they think is what they need to be giving on the first day of the week, that it might not be that we could re-examine what we're giving and see if we could find a little bit more to give. I heard Weldon Warnick tell this story a number of years ago about an old preacher who was beginning to preach, and he begins his sermon with this prayer, "Lord, help us to trust our souls in you." And throughout the auditorium, there were audible amens. He went on, "Lord, help us to give our bodies completely and wholly to you." And Brother Warnick said throughout the auditorium, the response was amen. There were a little more amens this time. And then he says, finally, as he brings the prayer to a close, "Lord, help us to put our trust in you so much that we're willing to give you our money as well." And total silence, kind of like now in the auditorium when he said that. You know, ask me for my time and I'll give you some of that. Ask me for my commitment. Ask me for my service to other people, but don't talk to me about money. Again, I know it's not a popular discussion. It's not a popular topic for us to consider, but I think it's necessary. Another preacher said one time, and this goes back over 100 years, but I like the way he worded it, "We are being plagued by a dangerous spiritual disease today. It is rheumatism of the heart caused by a contraction of the pocketbook." I think brethren have lived through times, you know, preaching brethren have lived through times when brethren were not very generous in terms of their giving. I don't know that that's true anymore. And again, I'm not doing this because I perceive there to be a problem in this local church. But just as a reminder, and as a reminder that we have ongoing needs. We have needs in terms of supporting the preaching of the gospel here and in other places. We have almost constantly are receiving requests for assistance in helping other men preach the gospel in other places. Requests that come in from time to time of a benevolent nature, of the needs of Christians in some kind of a material way in other places. And we have needs for a place where we can honor the command of God to assemble ourselves together and to teach and admonish one another in a way that would be effective. And so let's think about our giving. And that's the second part of the equation. When you make the decision that you're going to preach about giving, how do you approach it? What is the best way to do it? And I, just looking through my files, I've tried, I guess, just about every way that can be conceived of or imagined to remind people about the importance of giving and what the New Testament teaches about giving. But the one that I have found down through the years in Bible classes and sermons to be the most effective is the one that I want to share with you tonight. If you would open your New Testaments back up to 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and that text that we just read a few moments ago, I don't think there's a better place to go to think about what constitutes giving and what are the characteristics of giving and what are the attitudes that motivate us to give in a way that would be acceptable and pleasing to God. Then to consider together for a few minutes in the lesson tonight this incredible example that Paul gives in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 of the churches in Macedonia. By the churches in Macedonia, we know of at least two churches that Paul had planted in Macedonia. There might have been others, but we know that Paul planted the church at Philippi and wrote the letter that we call the Philippians in the New Testament to that group. Is one of the churches that existed in Macedonia. Thessalonica is another church that Paul planted that would have been in the province of Macedonia. And so at least those two churches, I think, are under consideration when Paul addresses the churches of Macedonia or talks about the churches of Macedonia in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. And I want us to notice in the lesson tonight five things that Paul says was characteristic of their giving. And what I want you to be doing, what I want to be doing myself, and this is always true when you preach, it's one of the real benefits to me of preaching, is self-evaluation. Is that when I'm putting a lesson together, any kind of a lesson, but especially a lesson like this, and I'm thinking, here's point number one, and here's what I want to say about that, and it gives me the opportunity to ask myself, does that characterize me? And here's point number two, and point number three, and number four, and number five. So this is not one-way communication. All of this applies to all of us, and with me at the very top of the list. But I want us to be thinking, I want all of us to be thinking as we look at these 5 points, just briefly tonight. Can it be said about me that this characterizes my giving? When I think about the amount that I give, when I look at how I have been prospered, and then when I look at all of my expenses and all of the things on which I spend the money that I earn from week to week, and then I compare that to how much of that I have appropriated or set aside in accordance with the teaching of 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. How much of that have I set aside? How in my budget and making my planning for how I'm going to spend my money, how big a part of that is this contribution or what I'm giving to God? 5 things, again, that characterize the giving of these Christians in the churches at Philippi and Thessalonica. And the first one is this, obviously, that they gave sacrificially. In verses 2 and 3, talks about the giving of the churches in Macedonia, that in a great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord. That's an incredibly powerful statement about the giving of these Christians in Macedonia, in Philippi and Thessalonica, and again, perhaps some other churches as well. He starts out by saying, in a great ordeal of affliction. You know, we don't know about the church at Philippi being persecuted. There's no biblical record of a strong persecution in Philippi, but we know that right from the very beginning, the church at Thessalonica underwent intense persecution. And that might very well have spilled over back up the road to the church at Philippi. That persecution in Thessalonica came from the Jews. And when you read 1 and 2 Thessalonians, you get the impression that, and those are among the first two letters that the Apostle Paul wrote, probably the first two letters that the Apostle Paul wrote, and they were written not long after Paul planted the church at Thessalonica, and you get the impression that persecution had gotten extremely intense by the time Paul writes those letters. It's possible. It doesn't specifically say it in either one of the letters, but it might be touching on or implying the idea in those two letters that some Christians had already even lost their lives because of their faith in the city of Thessalonica. So it's not hard to understand when you read about that intense persecution that the church at Thessalonica was undergoing, and Paul says, in a great ordeal of affliction. In other words, things were not going well in these churches. And it's very easy sometimes when things aren't going well to kind of get caught up in ourselves and lose sight of other people, lose sight of our responsibilities and the work that we have, the obligations that we have to the local church. But that's not the case in Thessalonica. In this great ordeal, their liberality overflowed. But not only that, he says that their abundance of joy and their deep poverty overflowed in the wealth of their liberality. Not only are they suffering intense persecution, but they are in poverty themselves. And yet, Paul says, they participated in this contribution that was being taken up for needy saints in other places. And as a matter of fact, he goes on in verse 3 to say, I testify according to their ability and beyond their ability. They gave of their own accord. The fact of the matter is, the Macedonian brethren might very well have been a candidate to receive some money themselves. It might have been that Paul later on would have been traveling around and collecting money from other churches so he could take it back to Macedonia to assist and help the needy saints there. That's how deep their poverty was. It was so deep, as a matter of fact, that Paul says, you're not obligated to participate in this work. You're not expected to be a part of this. But they insisted on doing it anyway. Look at verse 12. For if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has and not according to what he does not have. That's the attitude of these brethren in Macedonia. In their poverty, they were determined that they were going to help Christians in other places. Here's a work that needs to be done. And they didn't sit back and feel sorry for themselves. They didn't think, you know, we need to save this money for the churches here. We need to keep this money at home. We need to keep this money for ourselves. We want to participate in this work. They did, Paul says, what they were not expected by him to do. That's an amazing characteristic. Can it be said of me? And I hope you're asking yourself the same question. And it wouldn't be right for us to ask the question of somebody else. I mean, that would be the easy thing to do. For you to look around at somebody else and you think, well, you know, I can tell by looking at that person and what they wear and what they drive and the home in which they live that they're more prosperous than I am. I wonder if they're giving sacrificially. That would be the easy thing to do. But the question is, could that be said about me, whatever condition I find myself in? Whether I'm asking that question from a position of relative ease and material prosperity, or whether I'm asking myself that question from a position of material want and lack, and even persecution and suffering being present. Can it be said about me that my giving is sacrificial giving? In that same verse, in 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 2, Paul talks about their joy that they had in giving, the joyfulness of their giving. In the great ordeal of affliction, their abundance of joy caused them to abound in the wealth of their liberality. They had discovered what a lot of modern authors and people who study the mind and study human conduct and the things that make human beings tick have understood and come to learn down through the years, that there is a joy in giving, that Jesus was right when he's quoted in Acts chapter 20 and verse 35 as saying that it's more blessed to give than to receive. We've suggested many times in a lot of different contexts that the Greek word that's translated blessed very often, as a matter of fact, I'm convinced most often carries with it the idea of happiness. So that what Jesus is saying in Acts 20 and verse 35 is that happy are those who give. It makes a person happier to give than to receive. I think some people have a hard time understanding that. I know that children do, for example. When we think about the joy that children get in receiving things, receiving gifts. As a matter of fact, and the older you get, the more you come to realize that's the really exciting thing, is not what you receive, it's what you give and the happiness that you give to other people. But that's part of what characterized their giving. They took joy in their giving. And again, even in the face of persecution. In 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 7, verses 6 and 7, Paul goes on. He's still talking about giving in different contexts. He says in verse 6, "Now this I say, he who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully." And then in verse 7, "Each one must do as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver." I heard somebody say a number of years ago, and I don't remember who it was, but I heard somebody say that if giving is a chore or a challenge for you, if your giving to the local church on the first day of the week is something that you begrudge, it's something that you resent, it's something that you regret, that you would really be better served as far as God is concerned not giving anything at all. That sounded so strange to me, so odd to me. But the fact of the matter is, I think 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9 suggest to us that if there is not a joy in giving, if we're not giving for the right reason, because we love God, because we love His church, because we love the work that God gives us to do in the world, the work of preaching the gospel, the work of edifying and building up the local body, the work of benevolence that confronts us from time to time, needy saints, both locally and in other places, that if it doesn't give us joy to know that our giving is making it possible for the work that God intended for the local church to do, then there is indeed something wrong with our giving. I'm inclined to agree with the sentiment that if you're not giving joyfully, that you're better off probably just keeping it to yourself. Verse 3, in 2 Corinthians chapter 8, the Apostle Paul says that this giving was voluntary in nature. "For I testify that according to their ability and beyond their ability, they gave of their own accord." The New King James Translation says they were freely willing. If it was possible for... Well, let me take that back. Because it is possible, obviously, the way I want to say it, let me take it back. It is possible for God to command giving. And not only to command giving, but to command the amount of giving. God does that in the law of Moses, does He not? That's what we call tithing, what the Old Testament calls tithing. Tithe just means 10%. And you know, I suspect you've heard this point. I make this point sometimes in preaching on giving. That if a Jew living under the law of Moses was zealous, if they were determined that I'm going to give everything that God wants me to give, 10% doesn't represent what they gave. It would be considerably more than that. Some commentators have estimated when you take the first fruits into consideration and all the sacrifices into consideration, and you add that on top of the tithing, that a zealous Jew, a Jew who was determined to try to the best of their ability to live according to the law of Moses, was really probably giving God somewhere around 25 or 30%. Of their income on an annual basis. And I think that's probably pretty close to accurate or correct. So it is possible for God to command us to give. But the point is that when the law of Christ came in and replaced the law of Moses, God removed that mandatory restriction in regard to amount. We are instructed to give, to lay by in store on the first day of the week. But the question that most often is asked is how much? And sometimes I think we ask that question with the wrong motive or for the wrong reason. If we're asking the question how much because we're really struggling with and wrestling with and we're determined like that zealous Jew, we want to make sure that we give all that we need to be giving. If we're asking how much with that attitude in mind, that's one thing. If we're asking how much, and really I suspect that this is what motivates the question more often than not, how much really means how little. And that the reasoning process that some Christians really are going through is what is the least amount? When we look at our budget, when we look at our checkbook, when we sit down on Saturday night or Sunday morning to write a check or to set the money aside that we're going to give, what is the least amount of this that I can give and still be acceptable and pleasing to God? What is the most amount of this that I can keep for myself? I've mentioned Dave Ramsey before. I know that some of you listen sometimes to Dave Ramsey on the radio, the financial guru, who operates just down the road from Bowling Green here, not very far, has a national radio broadcast. I don't agree with all of Dave Ramsey's money principles. And, you know, saying that probably says something about me, considering where he is financially and where I am financially. For me to say I don't agree with everything he says about finances, but I don't. I don't agree with all of the religious principles that he espouses on his program. But one thing I love, one principle of Dave Ramsey that I love and really admire, is that Ramsey insists that when you are making the decision about how to spend your money, whether you are a high school student who gets an allowance or a college student who has a job and you're working to pay your own expenses, or whether you're a husband and wife team working to support a family, or whether you're older and your children are grown and gone and you're trying to figure out how you're going to make it through your older years, whatever situation you find yourself in, when you sit down and plan out how you're going to allocate your money from week to week, God comes first. And he's exactly right about that. God comes first. God comes ahead, and the commitment that we make to God comes ahead of what we owe the mortgage company. It comes ahead of the car payment. It comes ahead of paying the student loans off. It comes ahead of the credit card payments. It comes ahead of everything else. And I'm afraid that not only do people in the world not grasp that principle, I'm afraid sometimes that we don't grasp that principle. And we take this idea of voluntary to mean I can give as little as I can give as little as I can get away with, or I can even give nothing at all if I have other commitments, if I have other obligations. I can put God last on the list, and I'm going to make sure that I get all my entertainment needs met, that I've got all my tickets for entertainment or sporting events paid for. I'm going to make sure that I've got all my car payments made and my mortgage is paid. And I'm going to make sure I take care of myself first. And then, if I happen to have anything left, I'll give some of that maybe to God. One of the things that characterized the giving of these people is that they were freely willing. They gave of their own accord. 2 Corinthians chapter 8 and verse 8 suggests that we can't command an amount. I am not speaking this, Paul said, an apostle said, I am not speaking this as a command, but as proving through the earnestness of others the sincerity of your love also. In other words, this is a demonstration of your love. It's a demonstration of your commitment. If the verse 12, again, if the readiness is present, it is acceptable according to what a person has and not according to what he does not have. Again, the New King James says, if a willing mind is present. And so they gave voluntarily. Your giving, if you're a member of the Eastside Church, you're giving into the collection, into the treasury, into that collection that's taken up on the first day of the week. And again, because needs continue from week to week, that's a voluntary offering that you give. And Paul says how much you give in that voluntary offering is a demonstration, at least to God. It's a demonstration of the sincerity of your heart. How strong is your faith? How much do you love God? That was characteristic of the giving of these people in Macedonia. Number four, in verse 4 of 2 Corinthians chapter 8, they were persistent, begging us with much urging for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. You know, I've been preaching for a long time, and I've been around for a lot longer than I've been preaching. Well, some longer than I've been preaching. And my parents started taking me to a local group like this when I was a little baby. I don't believe, and you know, there's some of you have been around a lot longer than I have. Maybe you've seen this. I've never seen people begging for the opportunity to give. Have you? Yeah. Have you ever been in a local assembly where the brethren says, when are we going to give? When is the collection plate coming? Come on, let's do that first. I can't wait to contribute. I'm excited. I'm anxious. But I've never heard anybody say that. I've seen the sour looks on people's faces as the collection plate went around sometimes. You know, I've seen people, when the collection plate went around, I've seen the surprised look on people's faces. Almost like, oh, well, you know, money again. Well, let me grab my purse. Let's see if there's anything in there. Let me pull my billfold out. You know, I went to the game. I spent all this money yesterday. Let me see if I got anything left that I can drop in the collection plate. I mean, I've seen those emotions back, you know, when I was a lot more actively involved in passing around, serving people when it came time to take up the collection. But I've never seen people beg for the opportunity to give. That's what Paul says. Those are the exact words he uses. Begging us with much urging for the favor of participation in the support of the saints. Now again, remember, they were being persecuted and the persecution was severe and they were in poverty themselves. And so Paul says to them, you are exempt from this. You don't have to participate in this. As a matter of fact, you need help yourself. You all hang on and we'll help you when we can. But you all, now the church at Corinth, they're in a different situation. The church at Ephesus, they're in a different situation. But you churches in Macedonia, you're immune from this. They weren't looking for the easy way out. Which I think is what we sometimes do. I think sometimes, and this is true of me, in our reasoning, you know, we are inclined to think, well, you know, I might really need that money for myself. There might be a bill. I might have a car breakdown. I might have something go wrong at the house. I might have, you know, I might have a doctor's bill that I have to pay. And I'm just hesitant to part with that money. Begging us for the opportunity. They wouldn't take no for an answer. Incidentally, if the church at Philippi is one of these churches about which Paul is talking, and I think that it is, what do we know about the church at Philippi and their relationship with Paul? We know that years later, when Paul is in prison, who sends him money? Who sends him what he needs to take care of his daily? It's the church at Philippi that does that. There's that persistence that they're always going to be involved to the best of their ability in helping other people, doing the work of God. They gave persistently, begging us with much urging. How excited are you? How anxious are you when we come to that part of our service? I know we get pumped up and excited and we get emotionally charged about taking the Lord's Supper, and that's right. That's the proper response. And we get a great thrill out of singing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs and joining our voices together with other Christians. And we look forward to the times when we can pray together and lift up our petitions to God on behalf of us and on behalf of other people. That we anticipate those times and we look forward to those times. Do we feel that way about the opportunity that God gives us to give? To the point that something like this could be said about us, that we would not take no for an answer. We're not going to allow what's going on in our lives to keep us from worshiping and serving God. And let me suggest to you finally, number five, and the lesson will be yours. And this really kind of sums up, I think, and that was Paul's intention, I think, in verse 4, was to sum all of this up. He says, or verse 5, I'm sorry. The reason that all of this other was possible, the reason that they gave sacrificially and joyfully and voluntarily and persistently, is because first, he says, they gave themselves to God. They gave themselves to God first. I hadn't thought I'd go back there, but I think I've got time. Turn back to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. And I'm going to read several verses here. In the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 25. Again, these people were being persecuted, and yet they sacrificially, joyfully, voluntarily, persistently gave because they first gave themselves to God. How could they do that? I mean, how could they do that? Weren't they worried about their own condition? You know, weren't they concerned about taking care of themselves? Feeding themselves, you know, providing for their own needs. Weren't they worried about that? Look at what does Paul mean when he says they first gave themselves to God and to us? I think this is what he means in Matthew chapter 6, verse 25, beginning. For this reason, this is Jesus, of course, speaking. For this reason, I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more, worth much more than they? And who of you by being worried can add a single hour to his life? And why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will He not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then. What will we eat? Or what will we drink? Or what will we wear for clothing? For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these things. For your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. What did Paul mean when he said they first gave themselves to God? I think he means what Jesus said, seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and then just stop worrying about what goes on in your life from day to day. We, at the end of the day, we either have confidence and trust that God will provide for His children, that God will provide for His faithful people, or we don't. And that is very often reflected in our attitude about giving. We worry about what we're going to do about our futures. And so we spend our lives, you know, taking what we earn and setting it aside and saving up for the future. And I tell you, I've known people down through the years. I've known this happen more on multiple occasions where people were just so worried. What am I going to do when I get old? What am I going to do when I retire? Well, I'm going to, and then somebody will tell them, well, you're going to have $1 million or you won't be able to live. You're going to have $1.5 million or you won't, but how am I going to get $1 million between now and the time that I reach retirement? So I've got it now. I've got to take every spare penny and I've got to put it into the investment. And we worry ourselves sick about that. And we get to the point where we finally get ready to retire. And again, I've seen it happen multiple times. We don't live to spend what we've saved, what we've hoarded, what we've put away for ourselves. Or if we do live, we don't live in that kind of quality life that we thought we were going to live. You know, we're not those commercials you see about, you know, these people, they've reached retirement now. They're traveling all over the world and they're just enjoying their lives. That kind of thing happens sometimes. But again, I've seen it happen the other way too. And so we worry ourselves sick about something that doesn't even happen. Something that doesn't even concern us. And that's the point that Jesus is making here. If you have confidence and trust in God, why would we be worried about those things? I have to tell you this, just a little political comment. I know you, some of you hate that, which is why I do this from time to time. But what's going to happen to Social Security in this company? I have not lost a wink of sleep a single night in my life about the condition of the Social Security system in the United States of America. And the reason I haven't is because I believe what the Scriptures teach, that God will provide for His people. That what David said is true. I'm an old man, David said. I've lived a long time. I have never seen a child of God begging for food. God provides. Do we believe that? Do we have? I'm not talking about some kind of a miraculous multiplication of loaves and fishes, but do we believe what Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount? And if we do, then our primary concern is not what am I going to do 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 years down the road. My primary concern is what can I do now to serve God? What can I do now to serve other people? That's the condition in which Paul found the Macedonians. Why would they even want to give, considering the situation they found themselves in? Because they had already given themselves to God, Paul said. They're not worried about their poverty. They're not worried about where their next meal is coming from. They're not worried about sending their kids to school 30 years from now. They're not worried about how they're going to spend their retirement years. They're concerned about serving God today. J- just serving God today, taking care of today, and letting God take care of the rest of it. And so what does it mean when it says they first gave themselves to God? I think what that means is that they have just given themselves in complete confidence and trust to God. And my guess is that, and not just with us, but with most Christians in most local churches, if it could be said about all of us what was said about the Macedonians, that we've given ourselves completely and totally to God, what you would see is you would see a drastic increase in the contribution from week to week. That you see more and more people saying what the Macedonians said, give me opportunities, God, to give this away, to use it to glorify you, to use it to serve other people, to use it to help the work of the local church be done here and in other places. And so the Macedonians, what characterized them, among other things, is that they first gave themselves to God. Now, those are the five things. The lesson is yours. And again, there are lots of different ways that you can approach the subject of giving, but I like this one the best. And I'll ask again as we bring the lesson to a close, for you to ask yourself the question, when you think about what have you set aside, and it may not be the East Side Church, and this is not a plea, you know, for more money from the members of the East Side Church. It's just a plea for all of us as individuals to analyze and assess what we're doing to serve God, whether it's here or whether it's in some other place. Can it be said about me that my giving is sacrificial giving, even beyond my ability and beyond my means? Or would God view my giving as miserly and selfish and stingy giving? Can it be said about me that I give joyfully, that's a happy part of my worship and service to God on the first day of the week, that I look forward to that and to participating in that and sharing in that with other Christians? I look forward to that every bit as much as I do everything else that we do when we assemble together on the first day of the week. And I wouldn't want to miss that. I wouldn't want to not be a part of that. That my giving is voluntary. I'm not giving because I'm being compelled to give. I remember, you know, when I had small children and you give them money to put in the plate and you had to pry the fingers open. Remember, any of y'all ever have to do that, or any of y'all ever have that done to you? Maybe even when you were teenagers. Your mom and dad are prying your hands up. Drop that money in the plate. You're embarrassing. I mean, and I think some of us as adults almost feel that way, that the elders are, they're trying to pry the money out of, they can have it, and they'll have to pry it out of my cold, dead hands. You know, that we almost feel that way. Is our giving voluntary? You know, we're not doing this because we're compelled to do it. We're doing it because we want to, because we know the good that can be done in glorifying God and doing God's work. Are we persistent in our giving? That I am determined that this is going to be a regular and a consistent part of my relationship with God and my relationship with the local church. And all of that would be true if it could really be said of us that we have first given ourselves to God. What kind of givers are we? That's the question. Only you can answer that for yourselves. And I hope that you will. I hope that we will do that self-examination. And think about what we're giving to God. Again, whether it's here or whether it's in some other place, wherever it is, what we're giving to God, is it what God would be pleased with? Take out your songbooks and open them to number 340. That's the song that Brother Rich has selected to be the invitation song tonight. Not a lesson designed to teach the truth to those who aren't Christians, although we might very well have some who aren't Christians in the audience tonight. But we wouldn't close a service like this, regardless of the topic. We wouldn't close a service like this without giving you the opportunity, if the need is there, for you to obey the gospel. Become a Christian. If you're not a Christian, that means confessing your faith in Christ, saying that you believe that Jesus is God's Son, repenting of your sins, and being baptized for the remission of sins. And we'd be thrilled to help you do that tonight. It wouldn't take very long. You could be what God would have you to be. You could be a Christian, a child of God. Maybe help you come back into a right relationship with God if that's what your need is. Or maybe just pat you on the back or give you a hug and encourage you, pray for you and pray with you, and try to help you in any way that we can to be stronger and more dedicated and more faithful. If there's any way that we can serve you tonight, while we sing the words to this song, won't you please come down to the front and let us help you while we stand and sing.